America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. I'm Larry Rifkin. Say what you will about Nancy Pelosi. She is one of the most formidable political figures in the last 30 years. In fact, John Boehner, a former speaker and a Republican, concedes that she will likely be remembered as the most powerful House speaker in history. That's saying something, even eclipsing the aura surrounding the late Sam Rayburn. Let's not forget how she provided George W. Bush with the votes he needed to avoid a depression during the 2008 housing debacle, even as fellow Republicans balked. She was instrumental in passing the Affordable Care Act and all the COVID relief measures. When was the last time you can remember her bringing something to the House floor that got voted down? It just doesn't happen. The mistake many make is thinking she's a San Francisco liberal when she's learned her politics from her father, a former mayor of Baltimore and congressman for the area. She may be old school and new age at the same time, but she's a force to be reckoned with. We will reckon with it today on America Trends.
With me on America Trends is Molly Ball, and the book's called Pelosi. That's it. Pelosi. And I've got to ask you, of course, we're all talking about Nancy Pelosi. Molly, what does she like to be called? Is it Madam Speaker, just to make certain that people understand her role? Or is it Nancy? Is it Pelosi? I remember Donald Trump always calling her Nancy.
That's a good question. You know, I think like most of us, it depends who is addressing her. Certainly on the informal proceedings or on the floor of the House, it's Madam Speaker. With her grandchildren, it's Mimi. That's what the grandkids call her. And of course, her children call her Mom. But the custom in the House of Representatives is to refer to people as Mr. or Mrs. So you will hear commonly when you're hanging out around the House, that's how representatives will generally refer to each other, no matter what their sort of rank is. So I think the commonest form of address for her is probably just Mrs. Pelosi.
Okay. Now, I was an assistant to a commissioner of education in Connecticut, and we had the first woman ever elected on her own as governor, a very strong-willed and determined and capable woman, Ella Grasso. And I remember him, this commissioner, who was strong-willed himself, saying every time he went before her, he felt like a little boy in short pants. And I'm really wondering, because I've seen her, she can be so tough. She can really put you in your place with just one well-chosen phrase. I mean, what is her demeanor when you meet with her? Because she doesn't suffer fools very easily.
That's a really interesting question in a lot of ways, I think. On the one hand, yes, she's legendarily tough, no nonsense, particularly in negotiations. There's not a lot of beating around the bush. On the other hand, she is quite renowned among her colleagues in the House for her, for lack of a better word, feminine graces, for the courtesy that she extends to people, the amount that she listens to her constituents in the House Democratic Caucus. She's always, you know, sending people flowers, calling people who she's heard have a significant personal event in their lives. So she is very sort of classically gracious in that way, at least in private. But I do think that you raise something that's really interesting for women in politics, right? Because it is still so new, particularly at the national level, to have women in these high positions of authority. Nancy Pelosi being the first and to this day the only woman ever to lead a party in the Congress. She's had to navigate a lot of these issues, particularly men's attitudes, right? How does it, and so, you know, I don't think men have to think very much how a person might feel, how they might relate that experience to, you know, being parented. Nancy Pelosi, on the one hand, quite openly does draw inspiration from her years as a housewife and mother when it comes to how she herds her flock, right? She talks about the ways that having 5 children in 6 years, as she did back in the 1960s, helped her understand how to manage large groups of people. But on the other hand, I do think that, you know, it's something that every woman grapples with, is this question of how can you use your authority and stand firm in your authority without making people uncomfortable, and particularly without making men uncomfortable, given that a lot of men aren't used to taking orders from a woman. So I think it's a quite complicated thing for female politicians to navigate.
Now, those graces, how many of them are built in to the whole Gucci glove and iron fist approach, meaning she knows her members so well. She knows what buttons to push. She knows what they need for their district. I mean, she has an incredible amount of intelligence to know how this game is played. A lot of people don't remember that her father was in the House, that she's more Baltimore than she is San Francisco. So how much of that is a nicety, or how much of it is very calculating, like any great politician?
I don't think it's possible to separate, you know, the strategic from the emotional, if you will. But you do hear a lot of story. I mean, I think what people appreciate the most is the gestures for which there's no obvious payoff, right? You get a call because a parent is sick, or a spouse has died, or something has befallen your family, or she'll show up at something. I've heard about her, you know, showing up for a child's play and staying for the whole thing, and the person in question being astonished at, you know, all the other things she must have to do, and there is no obvious sort of transactional payoff for her in that kind of encounter. So you could see it as banking a lot of chits to use later, right? Building up political capital. But, you know, I think her political genius is in maintaining those relationships over the long term, regardless of whether she sees them, you know, paying off immediately. You know, as you mentioned, she was born and bred in Baltimore, and her father was a member of Congress when she was born and became the mayor of Baltimore when she was 7. She swore him in she held the Bible when he was sworn in as mayor, and he was the first Italian-American mayor of Baltimore. And so the politics that she learned at her father's knee was very much that sort of old-fashioned urban democratic machine politics, right? Of favor trading and different, you know, bosses for different ethnic groups and so on. So you do see her, you know, in her ability to count votes, and in her, you know, emphasis on knowing how to assemble, you know, cobble together the coalition for whatever particular bill, you do see a lot of traces of her father's style. But I think she adds to that a lot of her own influence, her own ideas about how to do things, whether it's the sort of more ideological San Francisco liberalism that she takes inspiration from, or just her own style, I think, as a woman.
How can we still say today that many times over she has been underestimated and yet undeterred? When you look at a major legislation in the 21st century, where was the financial bailout, where George W. Bush had to rely on her to push it through, the Affordable Care Act, all the pandemic legislation, and I would imagine all the things she'd like to see going forward with Joe Biden, how can anybody still question her effectiveness?
Well, it's a few things. I think any lawmaker knows that you're always going to be part of a group effort, right? And she hasn't been in an executive position like the president, where you're much more the sort of face of any given accomplishment. I think she has a tendency to to try to put herself in the background, whether it's out of a sort of, you know, Catholic schoolgirl modesty that she was taught at an early age, or whether it is a calculated strategic decision. I write in the book that in a lot of cases, she has strategically tried to give others credit for things that she had a large role in part because it adds to her political capital. It makes people pleased to be with her on whatever, you know, project she is doing. I think you have to add to that the multi-million-dollar campaign to demonize her, right? There's never been a House Speaker in history who has been the subject of literally hundreds of millions of dollars in attack ads, cycle after cycle. The Republicans coming out and admitting that their entire campaign strategy in a year like 2018, for example, was simply to hammer on this theme that you know, Nancy Pelosi, the San Francisco liberal, is scary, and that's why you shouldn't vote for Democrats. And I'm not saying there's anything unfair about that strategy. You know, politics ain't beanbag, and Nancy Pelosi, as much as anyone, knows that you've got to, you know, take a punch and throw a punch in this game. But it is certainly unprecedented in the way she has been held up as a national figure and treated in this negative manner. So I think that's part of it. And then lastly, the thing that I point out in the book is that she is so effective that in a lot of ways she makes it look easy. And in the interviews with her, she's described visualizing that famous image of the swan gliding gracefully under the water, but paddling furiously underneath. So it was something like the Affordable Care Act. Every history of it that you read, from the books that have been written to President Obama's own account in his book, tend to emphasize how difficult it was to get through the Senate. And there are pages and pages devoted to the wrangling and the negotiations and the back and forth with the Senate because it was really hard, whereas very little attention is devoted to getting it through the House, even though that was also really, 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 really hard. But because Nancy Pelosi was able to pull it off without any sort of public explosions and without making it look that difficult, I think her effectiveness tends to get overlooked for that reason.
Well, Sean Spicer has said, I don't know what kind of authority he is, that she's the best fundraiser for the GOP, and yet on many levels, she's been a great fundraiser for the Democrats. So does she enliven and really spur both parties on?
She certainly seems to. I mean, she's an intensely polarizing figure, and she seems to motivate Republicans quite a lot. You know, the reason they put her in ads isn't because they have special, you know, dislike for her. It's because it's an effective strategy. It works to mobilize Republican and conservative leaning voters to see her image because she is viewed so negatively by those types of voters. She's a very effective fundraiser for the Democratic Party. She's raised more than $1 billion, I believe, over the course of her entire time in politics. And she really came of age in the House at a time when money in politics was being revolutionized, at a time when, you know, a lot of the old restrictions on campaign finance were going away and massive fundraising was becoming the order of the day. And it's an instance where, you know, she often gets criticized from the left as being this sort of corporate figure or someone who's too cozy with the business world. I think anyone who's seen the millions of dollars the Chamber of Commerce has aimed at her in its campaigns would wonder if that's really correct. But you know, she's the kind of person who would always who although she herself doesn't like the idea of there being this money in politics, given that that's the lay of the land, she's going to try to succeed in that framework. So she's going to go out and try to raise the money, to spend the money for Democrats to win campaigns, even if she personally might like to see, you know, a world with campaign finance reform where that kind of thing isn't necessary. I will say she doesn't appear to be a motivator for liberal voters in the way that she is for conservative voters. And that's been the source of a lot of angst from her own party over the years, seeing her as something of a political liability, because she does tend to have this disproportionate ability to get the conservatives out to vote, but not so much the liberals.
Well, unlike Bernie Sanders, she doesn't start with the notion, what does he or she want the world to look like at the end? She asks, do we have the votes? And I think that's really an important consideration, particularly when people are talking today about President Joe Biden surprising people in his early days as president, that he's going as big as he is. Now, she seems to obviously support that agenda in public, but how much in private? I would imagine they might be talking about strategy, and she's saying, I can only go so far with the very small majority that I have, and I've got to take it piecemeal or whatever, because she is ultimately a pragmatist in so many ways.
She certainly is. However, I think we shall see about a lot of that in terms of how the Democrats' very narrow majority in the House may serve as a limit on their ambitions. But I think it is, again, testament to her skill at keeping her flock together that hasn't been as much a part of the discussion as, again, how Democrats get to 50 or 60 votes in the Senate, depending on what's needed. Because she is known to have this ability to rally her caucus when she's convinced that, you know, they've gotten the best deal that they can get in order to pass something. I think we've also seen the Democrats in both houses, I don't know if I would use the word radicalized, but somewhat galvanized by the Trump era and galvanized by the January 6th insurrection and attack on Congress. Whatever sort of hypothetical feelings of bipartisanship many even centrists might have had, have decreased a little bit because of those events and feeling, and there's a real hunger to get things done however they can. So I don't see her so far being much of a break or a check on Joe Biden's ambitions. But if she can't get the votes, she'll certainly tell him that. And there were times when she did have to tell Barack Obama, I can't get you the votes for that, because she knows, and she's always counting votes, and she doesn't tell people what they want to hear if she knows it's not the case.
Tell us, I mean, because a lot of people, by the way, this is Molly Ball. The book is called Pelosi, of course, about the speaker, Nancy Pelosi. Tell us how she knows that she's got the votes. I mean, she has a whip in Jim Clyburn. She has a former rival who's now her partner, Steny Hoyer, as the majority leader. But tell us how she knows with such certainty before she takes anything to the floor that she has votes. What's the process?
Well, I think more than anything, it is an instinct and it is a skill honed over decades of doing this work. And if there's anything that I hope gets across to people in reading my book, it is that this is a skill, that, you know, so much of our political discourse consists of sort of rhetoric and position taking and fire and fury, if you will. But governing is a skill, and it's something that you can be good or bad at, and you can learn to do. And she is someone who, I think, whether or not you agree with, you know, her policy goals, is just someone who is very good at that art and skill of the legislative process. So when she goes to count votes, she has that whip list in her mind. She knows, as you mentioned before, she knows not only every member of her caucus by name, but what district they come from and what the partisan makeup of that district is and what committees they're on and what committees they want to be on and who they're in a feud with and who they're allies with and what caucuses they're members of and so on and so forth. It's just a incredible amount of information, particularly if you're someone like me and can't even keep the faces straight. So just that encyclopedic knowledge, and then the fact that, you know, she has helped a lot of these people get elected. She's raised money for them. She's recruited them personally to run in a lot of cases because she is ceaselessly campaigning and raising money and working to preserve her majority in the House. So, you know, many of these people may owe her a favor, or they may anticipate owing her a favor in the future. But her persuasive tactics, you know, consist mostly of listening and making people feel heard. She will, as I mentioned before, she will tell them if there's something that they want that she can't give them. But she has a way of just letting people talk and talk, whether it's in a big caucus meeting or one-on-one, just letting get everything off their chest and sort of wear themselves out. Some of her members talk about these as therapy sessions or prayer sessions, when she just lets people pour their hearts out. And once they're sort of exhausted, she can confront them with the reality of the situation and tell them why she needs their vote or why whatever they want, you know, may not be possible.
some people might say, well, the Democrats are all aligned, but that's not true. You do have moderates, you do have the Squad, and she has had her squabbles with the Squad in public. And then, of course, the fact that she was able to help to cobble together a win in 2018 was pretty remarkable, at least to me, because I've been doing a lot of reporting with Fair Vote and others about the gerrymandering success of the Republicans that should have lasted them through 2020, and now we see with the census perhaps even longer. And yet to have that interrupted in 2018 was a pretty startling achievement, was it not?
Yes and no. I mean, we know that there is historically this effect of backlash against the incumbent president almost always in that first midterm election. And Trump may have inspired even more of that kind of reaction than your average incoming new president. So, you know, she certainly made sure that the Democrats capitalized on that dynamic, but it was also a key part of the strategy that they employed, which was to downplay Trump at every opportunity and to try to convince the American public that they had a positive agenda, because there was this, I think, public idea that all the Democrats stood for was being opposed to Trump. That was certainly something that the former president believed and said quite frequently. So you noticed in 2018, all of the Democratic candidates would avoid questions about Trump, particularly those in swing districts, and try to focus the conversation on health care, on jobs, on, you know, cleaning up government. That was the sort of three-part platform that she helped organize the party around. So, you know, the problem with gerrymandering is that for any party, to maximize your number of seats, you want to spread your partisans as thinly as possible. So at some point, the Republicans were almost the victims of their own success in that they had created so many districts that they could win, that they eroded, that meant that that many of those districts were not safe for them when particularly when the sort of demographics of the parties started changing, particularly, you know, when Trump came along, who rather than galvanizing the sort of traditional Republican base, reoriented the party much more, toward its sort of, rural, base and away from these, college-educated suburbanites that the party had previously relied on.
That's a great point. So this new census data, I heard her say, does not worry her, because she thinks although it's in some of the red states, it may be in some of the bluer parts of red states. Well, we'll have to see where that goes. But I want to ask you, in terms of her legacy, it's not too soon to start talking about that. And when she looks back at Sam Rayburn or Tip O'Neill, I mean, they are often seen as modern exemplars of very successful speakers. How do you think she looks at herself in that pantheon?
I doubt she spends a lot of time, you know, measuring herself, but, and I am not a historian or a political scientist, but when you speak to historians or political scientists who study these things, they do put her up in that pantheon. I even had one of Tip O'Neill's children tell me that he thought that Nancy Pelosi was a more effective speaker than his father had ever been. And so the scholars do put her up there in terms of effectiveness with a Sam Rayburn, with an LBJ, with a Tip O'Neill. And I think it's all the more remarkable that she has done this, she has managed to be this effective at a time when the conventional wisdom is that governing is impossible, that Washington is broken, that the legislative process in particular is so gridlocked and partisan that nothing can get done. She has proven that wrong over and over and over again. She has shown repeatedly that in this age of polarization and gridlock, she's still able to get major legislation through the House. So I think she deserves a lot of credit for that.
I know that she was one who put forward some ethics concerns about Newt Gingrich, but more closely, John Boehner and Paul Ryan, who were her predecessors, Republicans, who nobody really looks at and says, oh, they were wildly successful. They couldn't keep their own caucuses together. When she looks back, or does she at all look at what they did and say, I'm going to learn from that and I'm not going to make the same mistakes they did? Or I'm wondering whether she assesses their time in the service as speaker at all?
You know, she's not particularly interested in, I think she views these Republican speakers who were speaker in between her two speakerships as not beneath contempt exactly. She had relationships with them, but as sort of amateurs, frankly. And, you know, she had been speaker before from 2007 to 2011 and had been quite effective at that time. But so much of her effectiveness has come from party unity. From the time she entered Democratic leadership in 2001 and became the leader of the Democratic minority in 2003, that has always been her greatest strength, is keeping Democrats together. Now, she doesn't have particularly strong relationships across the aisle. She's not particularly known for her bipartisan sensibilities. But in this day and age, I think she correctly recognized, and before a lot of her co-partisans did, that it was keeping the party together that would maximize her leverage and give her the leverage she needed in negotiations with the other side, and enable her to do the things she wanted with Democratic votes. So again, this has been studied, and she has actually secured greater levels of unity among the Democratic caucus than any party leader in history.
And when I look across the aisle, I can't imagine that she thinks Kevin McCarthy is somebody who really can challenge her in terms of her political instincts. I just haven't seen it, but I'm not going to ask you to comment on that. Let me ask you about the whole notion of what Donald Trump meant to a Nancy Pelosi. She was not looking to undo him at the outset. She was reluctant to impeach him. And yet twice in public, she probably gave the sternest rebuke of any person, woman or man, to Donald Trump. That meeting that is so infamous now on December 11, 2018, when he said, well, Nancy can't speak because she's got problems in her caucus, and she upbraided him there. And then, of course, when she ripped up his State of the Union address, how important were those symbolically to her or for her and her caucus?
I don't think that those public gestures were particularly important, but it certainly is the case that in a lot of ways, Donald Trump was good for Nancy Pelosi, right? I mean, she was not in a good place when the Democrats lost the 2016 election. She was embattled within her own party. There was a feeling that not only that she was herself a political liability, but that she and Steny Hoyer and Jim Clyburn, after more than a decade leading the House Democrats and being quite up there in years, that they ought to move along and make way for a new generation, fresh faces to lead the party. So, you know, there was a movement among the House Democrats to try to deprive her of the votes for Speaker in 2016 and then again in 2018. But particularly in 2016, I think you saw her sort of political capital at a low ebb. And then because she was able to be so effective against Donald Trump, and because Donald Trump so galvanized so many Americans to vote for the Democratic Party, she really, I think, got a sort of second life and second speakership. And I document in the book quite at length the way her public image experienced a reversal because of episodes like that meeting. So, you know, I think those gestures were important in the public message that they sent, particularly to liberals and to women. And, you know, one of the ironies of that 2018 election that sent her back to the speakership was that it was powered more than anything by a historic upswell of women's activism. Literally never in American history have we seen this many women running for office, not to mention voting and organizing and all of that. So here we had the first woman Speaker of the House, up to that point the most powerful woman in American political history, being treated as a sort of embarrassing liability by her own party at a time when it was women really driving the party's success. So I think seeing her stand up to Trump, seeing her stand up for herself, was something that really gladdened the hearts of a lot of those little women who had come to political activism because of Trump. And so those gestures meant a lot to them.
Has she not committed to stepping away from the speakership as a part of the deal making to make certain she could reclaim it? And do you think she will hold to that in 2022? And what does that leave open for other women? Because as you say, the class of 2018, now they're a little young, perhaps, to take over. But clearly, there are some real stars in that group. So what do you think her future impact is going to be, both on the party and the Congress itself?
Well, she, as you mentioned, you know, she doesn't like to talk much about her potential retirement because she doesn't want to be seen as a lame duck. But she did at some point commit to this term limit that would have her leave the speakership, if not the Congress, in 2022. She has told me and several others that she was planning or at least thinking about retiring in 2016 if Hillary Clinton had won that election, and only stayed on because she felt compelled to lead the party in the Trump era. Recently said that she still plans to observe that term limit, but it's not something, it's a very delicate matter among the House Democrats, not something that a lot of people talk about. And I think the secondary question then is whether her two deputies, Clyburn and Hoyer, will choose to move along at the same time. They're all about the same age, in their early 80s, and they've been seen as sort of a unit. Jim Clyburn told me that he expects they would all leave at the same time. Steny Hoyer, not so much, but there's a big question about, you know, whether he would be able to win the speakership when and if, you know, Nancy Pelosi has moved on without him. So there's a lot of palace intrigue, a lot of drama, a lot of whispering among the House Democrats, and you know, a fair amount of angst over the fact that she hasn't anointed a clear successor. There's a couple of up-and-comers that people have their eyes on, and you sort of don't get to that position without her favor. But she's never, you know, clearly groomed someone to take over for her. And I've asked her about that. Plenty of people have asked her about that. And she has a couple. She says on the one hand, she says, "Well, I did that at some point. It was Chris Van Hollen. He left." Which, fair enough. Chris Van Hollen was a major ally of hers until he had a chance to take an open Senate seat in Maryland. But part of the reason he ran for that seat was that she wouldn't give him any assurance that she might move on soon and allow him to become Speaker. So I think, you know, there's a clear strategic imperative for her. If she did groom a successor, that person would become a threat to her at some point. But also, you know, she had to fight the establishment to get where she is. It's hard to remember today because she is such an establishment figure. But when she ran for leadership, she was not next in line for that position. And she did have to fight the sort of male-dominated Democratic establishment that was skeptical of her. And, you know, the word she got back through the House grapevine was that these powerful men were saying, well, who said she could run? So she was incensed by the idea that she had to ask somebody's permission. And she used that as motivation. But I think it's also something she really does believe, that the way you prove you have what it takes for these positions is by doing what it takes to win them, by getting the votes and having the support among your colleagues. And she'll say, you know, people ask when I'm going to pass the baton. Well, everybody's got a baton in their handbag, but it's up to them to take it out. So she's really someone who believes that if you want power, you have to show you can fight for it. And I think that also is informs her approach to this question of succession.
Just a couple more. Is there a president that she has served with and, you know, dealt with that she most respected for their political acumen?
I think that's got to be Barack Obama. They certainly had their disagreements, and she often felt was naive, did not have as many differences with him as she had with Bill Clinton over the years, where, you know, she was quite publicly critical. Now, of course, she was in a different position as a sort of rank and file House member versus a member of leadership. One of my favorite scenes in the book, one of the ones I hear about the most from readers, is when she was helping negotiate the TARP bailout at the time of the financial crash in 2008. And George W. Bush sort of elbowed her in the ribs and said, "You're going to miss me when I'm gone." And she said, "No, I won't." And she was wrong. In the Trump era, she very much did miss George W. Bush, and she was pretty open about that, that she felt that, you know, as much as she clashed with him, he was a breath of fresh air compared to the new guy. So, but, you know, the president she served alongside, having gotten to the House in 1987, was quite a scathing critic of Ronald Reagan, and George H.W. Bush, and so the only Democratic presidents she has served with have been Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, and now Joe Biden. So given that, you know, I think it's too soon to say how the how she's going to judge her time alongside Biden, I would say it's got to be Obama who she has most fondness for.
So what's left undone for her? I know that she is looking at this big agenda that Joe Biden has, a lot of it related to women, both at home and in the workplace, getting the Family Leave Act, you know, put on the books, violence against women restored, the Biden agenda, equal pay. I mean, is that what she's looking at right now, do you think?
I don't think it's quite that specific. You know, when I asked her about a year ago, what she felt, what unfinished business she had, essentially. It was, she wanted to make sure the Affordable Care Act was protected. But beyond that, it was really, she said that the top things on her radar were climate and income inequality, making the economy more fair. So the latter we see, you know, being the focus of a lot of these, you know, massive bills that the new president is proposing. But climate, I think, is a major, major priority for her. She got the cap and trade bill through the House at arguably great political expense back in 2009, and then was very disappointed when the Senate decided not to take it up. It was a bill that, you know, she actually got Republican votes for this bill. She compromised quite a bit with moderates and Republicans in order to get it passed, to the point that any environmentalists actually opposed the bill. But you can look back and say that is now the only major climate legislation that has ever passed a House of Congress. So I think she very much regrets that they weren't able to act on that the last time they had the opportunity, and she very much hopes that progress will be made on this issue, on that issue, during her current speakership.
In closing, the troika of Joe Biden, Chuck Schumer, Nancy Pelosi. It looks like it's working. They work together. But what are you seeing in that dynamic?
Well, a couple of things. You know, when she would become frustrated with President Obama, it was usually because he didn't really know how things worked, right? She thought that he was naive about the prospect of working with Republicans. She thought he didn't necessarily understand the give and take of the legislative process, having only, you know, been in the Senate for a couple of years and never being in the House. So I think being teamed up with a legislative veteran like Joe Biden is much more comfortable for her, because, you know, although he was never in the House either, he's very much a creature of the Senate. He is, like her, you know, a proceduralist, institutionalist, a vote counter, not somebody who, you know, Obama came in saying Washington is broken and I'm going to fix it. And that's kind of offensive if you're a veteran of the Washington process, right? Who's being implicitly sort of shamed by that idea. So I think the partnership with Biden, they really do see eye to eye on a lot of these, you know, legislative strategy questions. And then Schumer, you know, she had a very effective partnership with Schumer under Trump. But when she would get frustrated with him would be when she sometimes thought that he wasn't tough enough. Nobody's ever tough enough for Nancy Pelosi, but there were times when she felt that you know, that he caved when he could have stood firm. And that's not the Schumer we have seen as majority leader. The Chuck Schumer, and I've talked to, you know, Democrats in the Senate who are kind of astonished that he's taken such an assertive, aggressive stance. But it's very much a Pelosi-type stance that Schumer has taken in wanting to be aggressive on policy. So I think they're pretty much, they're probably more in sync now than they've ever been.
Well, he was watching Mitch McConnell. Well, I want to thank you, Molly Ball, for this wonderful book with a new afterword, and it is available to you, a New York Times bestseller. And I thank you so much for being with us today on America Trends.
Thanks so much for having me. It was really fun.